Thanks, Jimi Hendrix. This is Eric Mann. You're back on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM. And in the studio with Scott Ritter, who most of you or many of you know. The formal thing we'll read here, and I have some other stuff, is former chief weapons inspector for the UN Special Commission in Iraq, has been an outspoken critic of the war in Iraq. Ritter has repeatedly challenged the Bush administration's contention that Baghdad's weapons system posed a grave risk to the U.S. In his recent book, Iraq Confidential, which he's here to publicize and get out, Ritter argues that the Bush administration's only objective in Iraq was regime change. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Okay. I got a couple more information, kind of framing announcements here. One is a plug for your 2 hour from now speaking engagement. U.S. Tour of Duty presents How We Got Into Iraq and How to Get Out, featuring in person Scott Ritter. Monday, December 5th, which is tonight, 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Venice United Methodist Church, 1020 Victoria Avenue in Venice, California, one block north of Venice Boulevard at Lincoln. That's easy. You still got 3 hours to get there. It's moderated by Lila Garrett, host of KPFK's Connect the Dots. And a book sale and signing will follow the event. And as an author, you gotta have a book sale and signing. Otherwise, why'd you write the book? Doors are open at 6:30. Seating's on first-come, first-served basis. It's wheelchair accessible. There's a suggested donation. And for more information, you can call 310-842-8794 or visit www.ustouroduty.org. Okay, I got rid of all my duties. So a couple of questions, Scott, and I want to go actually into some of the early parts of the book, and we're going to go through the book. I didn't read everything, but I read... took about 5 hours, and it's the type of book you need a little bit more time with, because I think it has a kind of a slow, careful building up of a case, line by line. So let me start by saying this. You start out by saying, in August 1998, I walked away from the best job I ever had and probably would have in my life. For nearly 7 years, I served as a UN inspector who, like others of my colleagues, had been mandated by the UN Security Council to oversee the disarmament of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction as part of the UN Special Commission, or is it pronounced UNSCOM. In my role as an UNSCOM inspector, I was provided with an opportunity that was unique. I was able not only to plan and implement inspections, but also to have control of the direction, collection, assessment of the intelligence information used in every phase of these operations. So let me start with a framing question, because it involves how you got involved. The audience, many of our audience here, assumes Bush is the bad guy. But didn't the Clinton administration also want to keep the heat on Hussein, to topple Hussein by the embargo, in which millions of people died, while not wanting to invade and reoccupy, although we'll discuss that later? Wasn't the Clinton administration's policy also a violation of international law and a crime against humanity? That is to say, in your early stages, you pointed that all along the inspections were a pretense for maintaining the embargo, which was many of the factors that undermined your ability to even do your job.
Yeah, it started even before the Clinton administration. 1991, of course, was the time of the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush 41. He had promised the American people in the lead-up to the first Gulf War in a speech in October 1990, that he was going to hold to account a man he called the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. And he said that there would be Nuremberg-like retribution. When you make those kind of statements, you're basically promising you're going to deliver Saddam Hussein's head on a platter. Now, we went to war. I fought in that war. It was a war of the liberation of Kuwait. It wasn't a war of regime change. So when the war ended, Kuwait was liberated, and American troops came home. Saddam's army was defeated. His economy was in tatters. And yet, George Herbert Walker Bush had a political problem, a domestic political problem, called the survival of Saddam Hussein.
That's right.
He had promised Saddam Hussein's demise and had not delivered. So the CIA told him that they thought that Saddam would collapse within 6 months of his own volition if they could just sustain economic sanctions. But they needed a new excuse for sanctions, because the old sanctions were linked to the occupation of Kuwait. Kuwait was now liberated. So weapons of mass destruction became the buzz concept. UN inspectors were created, mandated to go in and disarm. But the real reason behind picking weapons of mass destruction and disarmament was to find something to link economic sanctions to. So what they did is they said that sanctions will be continued and sustained until which time Iraq is found to be disarmed. Paragraph 14 of the resolution creating the inspection said that if Iraq is found to be disarmed, the sanctions will be lifted. This resolution was passed in April 1991. In May 1991, Secretary of State James Baker testifies before the Congress of the United States and says even if Iraq complies with its obligation to disarm, economic sanctions will be maintained until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power, thereby underscoring the reality that the U.S. did not have a policy of disarmament, but rather a policy of regime change. Now, it was started by George Herbert Walker Bush, inherited by Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton, as you rightly point out, not only sustained this policy, but over the course of his administration expanded on it. You know, we call the current occupation of Iraq George W. Bush's war. But it's more accurate to say that it's George W. Bush's and Bill Clinton's war, because Bill Clinton basically put in place the policy of regime change, of sanctions-based containment, of American policies that, according to Madeleine Albright, said that it's worth the price to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iraqi children die for the sole purpose of containing Saddam Hussein through economic sanctions until the United States could find the means of overthrowing him. As a weapons inspector, you know, we weren't focused on the morality of sanctions. It wasn't our business. Our job was disarmament. But where the two come entwined is, as long as we find Iraq not to be disarmed, these sanctions continue with horrific results. We were eyewitnesses to, you know, just what these sanctions were doing. We weren't allowed to do our job. Disarmament was actually the enemy of American policy, because if you disarm Iraq, now you have to talk about lifting sanctions. And if you lift sanctions, you've broken containment. And if you break containment, Iraq comes back into the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein at the helm. This was not what the U.S. wanted. It's also curious. We keep talking about regime change. We didn't want regime change during the Bush administration or Clinton administration. We wanted name change. Just get rid of Saddam and keep the Ba'athist Party in place. That shows the utter hypocrisy of all of this.
Well, in the book, the reason I'm staying there, because I think that actually frames, as you've pointed out, from Security Council 87 in the beginning, I'm very interested in some of the initial historical framing. Because as you pointed out, was even arms inspection itself a valid objective? Let me just take a minute. If, in fact, Saddam was beaten back to his own borders, if, in fact, Kuwait had been secured, there's been a history of onerous pieces imposed on other forces that lead to unfair dynamics. Every time Iraq tried to argue that its own sovereignty was at stake, the United States seemed to have no interest in Iraqi sovereignty. So wasn't the premise itself of Security Council Resolution 687 one where, if I can explain, there's sort of two dynamics. You were the honest broker on arms inspection, and your book is terrific on that, and I'll go back into that in a minute. But should the arms inspections themselves have been a valid agent of international policy?
If the policy was disarmament, and if the arms inspections followed through with the promise of disarmament, that is, that it's not just about Iraq, but it's about the region. That if we're going to get rid of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that has to become the starting place for a broader disarmament. And this is where that argument falls apart, because it sounds great on paper, but remember, the only reason why we were in Iraq is because we went to war in Iraq. The only reason we were able to get weapons inspectors to do disarmament in Iraq is because Iraq was defeated on the field of battle.
Right.
A lot of people say, oh, disarmament's about peace and all this stuff. The disarmament of Iraq was an extension of war, and people need to understand that. And that's one of the failings of that whole process, is that it wasn't a process of legitimate disarmament or nonproliferation. It was an imposed process designed to degrade and humiliate a nation to achieve a political objective, the removal of Saddam Hussein, and disguised as something noble. When you read the resolution 687 that created the inspectors, on the surface it looks like a disarmament document. Its real objective, though, is regime change, and
right.
That's why the whole process has been corrupted, and the integrity of disarmament as a whole has been brought into question. That's why it's very difficult to talk about today putting weapons inspectors in place in Iran and elsewhere, because the real question is, why? Are they there to disarm? Are they there to prevent proliferation? Or are they there as a cover for another objective, namely regime change.
Well, exactly. And the reason I want to stay on the Clinton administration a lot is because we're going to get in the sort of second half of this interview, which we're going to do for a subsequent time, a little bit more into the Bush administration. But you have a terrific story in there where you have determined three presidential palaces that have not yet been declared as presidential palaces. And you see a technicality, which we'll get into, as a way for you to try to make some inspections there. But the Albright Clinton White House tells you, no, you're supposed to go after, what exactly was it again? The
Ministry of Defense.
The Ministry of Defense, which is a violation of their sovereignty. And you go in there, and as I remember the story, you do agree to go into the Ministry of Defense, and you do negotiate with them, basically saying that if they don't accept this this inspection, that the whole process is going to fall apart. They let you in, you find nothing, you declare nothing, and then you're in trouble, real trouble, with the U.S. government. Why don't you tell us a little about that? It's a great story, by the way.
Well, thanks. It begins in, the scene set in December of 1997, where Richard Butler, the Australian diplomat who runs the inspections, is in Iraq talking with the Iraqi government about inspector access to sensitive sites. And the Iraqis go through different categories. And one of the sites mentioned is the Ministry of Defense. And Tariq Aziz, the deputy prime minister, says, if you go to the Ministry of Defense, that will mean war. There's no legitimate reason for you to go there. That touches on the national security and the defense and the sovereignty of Iraq, the dignity of Iraq. Butler comes back and reports this to the United States government. In January, we're trying to, again, speak about getting into difficult sites, January, February, and the Iraqis had balked about going to presidential sites. And so Kofi Annan went to Iraq and negotiated what's called a memorandum of understanding to gain access to these presidential sites, and we're supposed to test this. I said, look, if you want to test presidential sites, here's an interesting case. We have information. There's at least three places that are treated like presidential, but they weren't in the Iraqi declaration. So let's find out if the Iraqis are really willing to give us total access to every site outside. Let's go there. And the U.S. government, no, too complicated. We want you to go to the Ministry of Defense. I said, but that's not a presidential site. We're not testing the memorandum of understanding by going to the Ministry of Defense. Furthermore, there's no reason for us to go there. There's no disarmament reason. We don't have any intelligence. No. You have to go because the Iraqis have said, if you go there, this means war, which is what the U.S. wanted. They were putting in place a military campaign that would bomb Iraq, targeting Saddam, but they needed a trigger, and that trigger would be inspections. I went down to Washington, D.C. to sell the inspection concept to the White House. While I was there, Richard Butler met with Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor, Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State. We come back and meet at the U.S. Mission, the Embassy of the United States to the United Nations, in the offices of Bill Richardson, who was the ambassador at the time. And Richard Butler, a United Nations official, stands up before this whiteboard, pulls out his marker, and writes two timelines down. The first says inspections. The other one is military action. And then he writes the dates in March, and he circles the 8th of March. And he turns to me, because I'm the chief inspector, and he says, we have to have a confrontation with Iraq by here on this date so the U.S. can begin bombing on this date. Because they have to be finished by the 15th because of a religious holiday. And I said, wait, what's going on here? We are going to war inspections? It was a very, very confusing situation. But if I had pulled out, they would have found somebody to go in who would have played the game. I had no choice but to go on that mission. And if Iraq chose not to cooperate, if Iraq didn't want to do their job, so be it. I could leave with a clean conscience. But I had to give every chance for inspections to work. And one of the things I'm proudest of is the fact that I was able to sit down with Amar Rashid, who was a minister of oil at that time, former weapons official in Iraq, and negotiate legitimate, viable inspections of the Ministry of Defense that met not only our objectives as inspectors, but respected the dignity and sovereignty and national security of Iraq. It was a very successful inspection for weapons inspections, but it didn't start the war. And when I came back, I found out that the U.S. government was extremely mad at me because I had basically stopped Madeleine Albright's nice little war that she was plotting.
Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontline, KPFK 90.7 FM, and with Scott Ritter. His new book is Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam Hussein. Another thing in reading your book is I am, even though I've understood this analytically, here you are as in a UN special commission. But in the book, it shows that there's pretty blurry lines that the U.S. dominates the U.N. And then the CIA and the State Department are trying to dominate the U.S. And the CIA is trying to basically feed you information, much of which is false. But one of the things I was struck by is you mentioned England, you mentioned the United States, you mentioned a Serbian, but much of this U.N. inspection is a U.S. inspection, right? And one of the stories that I think is amazing in your book is you're going to three different meetings in which it's hard to remember which meeting you're going to. I mean, one is the UN meeting, which is infiltrated by the US. One is the US meeting, which is infiltrated by the CIA. And you're also trying to get CIA information, both rightfully and wrongfully, to figure out what are the basis for your inspections. Why don't you talk about how was it for you as a, quote, American, but also representing the United Nations and trying to do an honest job with those phenomenal conflicts of interest in the framing of your own experience?
Well, you know, when I first joined the UN as a weapons inspector, first and foremost, I'm an American, and a lot of people can be upset with me on that, but I'm very prejudiced towards America. I love my country, and I'm also a former intelligence officer.
Right.
I'm not a baby.
Right.
I know how to play the game. And there is a game being played out there in the intelligence business. It's a game that can be played with integrity. It must be played with integrity. But, you know, we don't always do what we say we're doing. There's behind-the-scenes work. So I went down to the State Department, and I said, look, what's the deal? Here I am. I got this job. I'm creating an intelligence capability in the UN. What's my mandate from the U.S. government? I know what the U.N. says, but what's my mandate from the U.S. government? Is there a hidden objective here, back-channel communications? And I was told point-blank, your job is to implement Security Council Resolution 687. I said, are you certain about that? They said, yes. That became my marching orders from my government. So now, as I'm proceeding to try and disarm Iraq, the United States is a Security Council member, so you can't ignore them. They're also one of the most powerful nations on the face of the earth.
Right.
So when you sit down with a UN meeting, there's going to be an American presence. And the U.S. claims that it wants to help us disarm Iraq, but there's this hidden policy of regime change there. So we're at a UN meeting where we got the U.S. government present, but they're saying things that aren't making sense. So now we follow up. I go down to Washington, D.C., and I'll meet at the State Department to get the quote-unquote U.S. government take on what they want. And again, they reiterate, disarmament. But at the table now, this interagency group, we've got the CIA, and they've got their own objective. So then I'll meet with the CIA to talk about specific CIA support to an inspection, and you're meeting with people who are at the same time not only helping you do your job in Iraq, but plotting to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, some people would say that because I met with the U.S. government, at the UN, at the State Department, the CIA, that I'm culpable on all of this, that I've been complicit in facilitating America's hidden policy of regime change. And the irony is that, we knew about the regime change policy the whole time we're carrying out these meetings. But what I was doing by going to these meetings is trying to frame my work with as much integrity as possible to say that everything I do and everything I've asked the U.S. government to do is in keeping with the mandate of disarmament, and therefore I'm following not only the UN instructions, but the instructions of my government. Then you get stabbed in the back behind the scenes because they're saying one thing to you in public or in these meetings, and they're doing something completely different in private, and it basically destroyed the integrity of the entire inspection operation.
Well, I'll come back to the question of not are you complicit, but are you complexly involved at least, because I was very good friends with Daniel Ellsberg at one time, and he said, look, the dilemma for me is I could not issue the Pentagon Papers if I wasn't working for the Pentagon. I am both a hero for getting rid of the secrets, but I'm also in some way, whether it's complicit or involved, because how did I get those secrets if I wasn't working for the war in Vietnam? So one of the questions I'm trying to understand, not to put you on the spot, but isn't it a moral dilemma? Didn't you go through a lot of moral dilemmas about who am I in this process? Because a lot of this story is double cross after double cross by forces that you thought were your allies.
Well, you're absolutely right. Look, there was a moral dilemma that started from the very beginning when I received my marching instructions from the U.S. government to basically implement the Security Council mandate, which the U.S. government voted for. Right from the start, I have conflicts with the CIA. And it became obvious that this was going to be a problem. So what do you do, quit, cut and run? Well, if you cut and run, then you're not doing anybody any favors. All you could do, at least all I could do, is maintain the course with as much integrity as possible and fight the good fight to try and disarm Iraq, to keep Iraq disarmed. But you're right. Every turn, every step of the way, every turn that we made in this, and this is highlighted in the book, you just run into a brick wall called U.S. government duplicity, the CIA, saying one thing, doing another. And, ultimately, in 1998, it became clear that I wasn't going to be allowed to do my job with integrity. I mean, they basically confronted me with, they wanted me to stay the course as an inspector and play their little game where we just did inspections that didn't inspect. They were inspections that provoked, inspections that maintained a public perception of a non-compliant Iraq. But the last thing they wanted me to do was disarm. And at that point in time, it became obvious that I could no longer carry out my job with the integrity required of the original mandate given to me, not by the UN, but by my own government.
Well, with Scott Ritter, his new book is Iraq Confidential. He's going to be speaking tonight in Venice at 7:30. At the end of the interview, we'll give the information again. again, I have to say, a fascinating, fascinating read, because I think one of the things a lot of people don't understand is the institutional workings of this country. And this is a pretty eerie story. I mean, it's more eerie about the country than Iraq in itself. Why don't you tell us the story about your actual, since you were also dealing with Iraqi intelligence, and when the Iraqi intelligence told you, and I didn't get the implication that with the French in some way supportive of that, that the Iraqis told you, hey, listen, I'm checking out all your phone calls, I'm listening in, you think you're spying on us, we're spying on you, and they giving you back information that they had on the U.S. Correspondence and so forth. Why don't you tell us about that? And also your personal relations with them, because you had to have some dealings with the Iraqis besides just being a heavy.
What's interesting to note is that today we know that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction,
right,
at the time of the invasion. In fact, we know, and the CIA agrees, that Iraq had destroyed all of their weapons in the summer of 1991. But as a weapons inspector, we didn't know that.
Right.
We didn't operate with that certainty of knowledge. We knew we had done a good job, but there was still unaccounted for material that we were searching for. The Iraqi government, however, knew that they had destroyed all their weapons.
Right.
And so they're wondering, why are we having these conflicts with these inspectors? What's going on? What's the hidden agenda? And the Iraqi intelligence service has as a responsibility the security of Iraq. And they viewed the weapons inspections as a process that threatened their security. So they wanted to know what was going on. They had to get into the minds of the inspectors. And so they sought to infiltrate our work. They needed to know what we were thinking to find out if we were legitimately disarming or going after the president. Now, we as inspectors are detecting some of this, and we're saying, oh, they're trying to spy on us. They're trying to get inside to find out where we're going so they can hide weapons. So you had this interesting dynamic taking place where the Iraqis were actually trying to help us figure out, you know, what happened to the weapons. But we distrusted them, so we would enhance our security. And then they, in order to find out what we were doing, would try and penetrate that security. So you had this vicious cycle taking place. It led to one instance where I was assigned an Iraqi manager by the intelligence services, a man I called the Serb. I didn't know that he had been assigned to me. I suspected it because we would go on these walks where we would have dialogue. He would tell me what, you know, behind the scenes, try and encourage me to do certain things, tell me other things weren't smart. I assumed since he was walking with me, he had to be intelligence because no one gets that freedom of action. But I found out later that he was actually tasked by the Iraqi intelligence service to serve as the conduit for the Iraqi government to feed me behind-the-scenes information so that we would, you know, not waste our time looking down what certain venues, et cetera. But it turns out that, you know, the Iraqi government, in order to find out what we're doing, we had secure phones, encrypted phones. And the French actually assisted the Iraqis in breaking the codes of our phone. Now, we don't know if it was French government. The French had an economic attaché in Baghdad who was working very hard to get sanctions lifted. And there's a lot of feeling that he may have taken three Iraqis back to Paris to work with rogue French people who weren't working on government instructions but working offline. And they broke the codes to our phone so the Iraqis could actually listen into our conversations. One of the things that the Iraqis picked up is that the deputy executive chairman of UNSCOM, an American named Charles Dulfer, was speaking to the State Department, the CIA, from Baghdad about regime change and how to use the inspection process to facilitate regime change. He thought this was a conversation taking place in secrecy, and the Iraqis are listening into it, again, underscoring the fact that America's policy of regime change was destroying the integrity of the inspections in the eyes of the Iraqis.
And also, I think it's a real racist misassessment of the other side, that they're pretty good, too. I mean, if you want to play this game, you have the U.S. CIA, you have the British intelligence, but they broke your code. You know, and then I'll end by saying, on the first half of this interview, that I'm with Scott Ritter, the author of Iraq Confidential. He's going to be speaking tonight at the Venice United Methodist Church, 1020 Victoria Avenue in Venice, at 7:30 to 9. You got to get copies of this book. This book is a trip. And you can call 310-842-8794. So as I say, to end this interview, isn't it interesting that you began the inspections in 1991, at the very time when there weren't any weapons of mass destruction? You spent 7 years as what I would call an honest actor, trying to do your job, when all along U.S. policy during the first end of the Bush administration, and much of that is now the Bill Clinton, Sandy Berger, Madeleine Albright era, of not wanting you to succeed. Is that fair?
That's
the goal was
correct.
That the very people who sent you there wanted the pretense, wanted to send you up all these blind alleys, because if you couldn't find weapons of mass destruction, but if you couldn't prove they didn't exist, the embargo could exist. If the embargo could exist, there was even a great section in your book where you talk about eventually they want to get into changing the terms of mistreating the inspectors as a ground for invasion. So this slippery slope of it didn't matter what the heck was the pretense, that Clinton himself was ready for an invasion that in many ways you prevented.
Well, it's absolutely correct. Again, people call this George W. Bush's war. It's Bill Clinton's war, every bit as much as his Bush war. I was in the Judiciary Committee, and the Democrats now are trying to prosecute Republicans for crimes. And what's important is that, if you're going to prosecute the Republicans, go all the way back, because if you're going to indict the Bush administration, you have to indict Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger and Bill Clinton as well.
Scott Ritter, terrific. It's a real pleasure. You're a good guy, and the book is really excellent. I urge people to get it. It's by Nation Books. Go on Amazon. Go to a local independent bookseller. So, thanks for joining us this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Francisca Porchas and Scott Ritter. Today, we had music from Fela Kuti, Sizzla, Jimi Hendrix, and the Orlandivo. You can listen to previous Voices show at www.thestrategycenter.org, and we have a new comment line, voices@thestrategycenter.org. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, production assistant, Lisa Adler, our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. We'll see you next week, and up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And come out tonight and hear Scott Ritter, buy his book. And the engineer is Jazz Shepherd. Sorry, brother. That's what happens when they give me written stuff. Thank you so much.